From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In the introduction to her new book, the journalist Dana Goldstein says she began the project with this observation, that public school teaching had become the most controversial profession in America. Think about it. The debates over teachers' unions and tenure and test scores, not to mention the underlying suspicions about incompetence and cushy workloads. Goldstein figured that all of this was relatively new, but as she dug in, she learned this kind of tension has been around for more than 200 years, and that every movement to reform the system has had the same kinds of elements. The key to understanding all of this, then, she realized, is history. Today in the program, Dana Goldstein is joining us to talk about the history of our most embattled profession. Her book is called The Teacher Wars. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In her new book, The Teacher Wars, journalist Dana Goldstein points out that we've been arguing about education in this country for more than 200 years now. And you'd think we would have figured this out. But she says we keep asking the same kinds of questions about teachers. How much should we pay them? How should we educate them and train them? And what are the best ways to evaluate them and fire them? There, of course, have been multiple reform movements and strategies and policy changes. But Dana Goldstein says very little in the way of consensus has actually emerged. Teachers today, she says, are resented, but then they're also idealized. The key to understanding all of this, she says, is history. That is just how it is that we got here. And her book is very much about history. In fact, it's called A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Dana Goldstein is a journalist, a staff writer at the Marshall Project. It's a new online news organization focused on criminal justice. She's also been an associate editor for The Daily Beast and The American Prospect. And she's joining us today from NPR in New York City. And Dana Goldstein, welcome. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
You say you came to this project with sympathy for teachers. And we should point out your father is or was a public school teacher.
He is a retired public school educator, and he was both a teacher and an administrator.
Okay, so he's got both perspectives there. So what kind of influence, I wondered, first of all, did that have on the way, you reported this issue and the way you've been thinking about this issue?
You know, it's interesting. My father as an administrator was sometimes in the position of having to figure out what to do about an ineffective or a bad teacher. But he had been a teacher himself, and he'd even gone on strike with his teacher's union. So I do like to think that I grew up with a good 360-degree view of these difficult issues. But even equally as influential on me was the fact that I attended public schools, and I had great public school teachers. And I attended diverse public schools, so public schools that had, you know, a broad range of races and classes represented in the student population. So I've been interested in public education my whole life.
Early on, you write about, I guess, what seems to be kind of the caricature of the bad teacher. It's this feared character, you say, kind of a vampiric type.
And I compare that picture to sort of past, you know, moral panics that we've had about, pregnant women that are using crack or welfare queens and, you know, this sense that we're spending public dollars on someone who's irresponsible. And I think we see that in the portrayal of tenured, ineffective teachers who are coasting by. They're not engaged with their lessons. That's the sort of picture that we often see painted.
Are we in the midst of one of these moral panics now, you think?
I actually think we're coming out of it a little bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, I started on this beat in 2007, and I noticed around the presidential race in 2008 that there was a lot of panic about bad teaching.
Yeah.
And then when the recession hit, I saw teachers kind of bearing the brunt of some of the conversation about, well, what do we do about inequality in our society? What do we do about child poverty? And perhaps teachers are the ones that are failing us. I think that over the past 7-8 years, we've actually moderated the conversation a little bit. And you know, I think that's why this book is coming out at an interesting time.
When we're headed in a different direction maybe in somewhere? We're starting to figure out some of these questions, you think?
Well, I think that, you know, when George W. Bush signed No Child Left Behind into law in 2001, it inaugurated what has been this sort of decade and a half of school reforms that are very much tied to rewards and punishments for adults based on kids' standardized test scores. And over the past 2 years, I would say, we've seen more and more parents and teachers and sometimes students themselves questioning this. Has too much of our system, because of our fears of bad teaching, has too much of our system now been totally rejiggered to focus on testing? So the conversation is opening up a little bit, I would say.
You write that the focus on the worst of the worst, which we tend to do, I think, represents, you say, what the true scale and the character of what may be a genuine problem. Explain that, because you say most of the public has come to see teaching, pretty broadly speaking, we should say, though, as a kind of failed profession.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the way that politicians talk about teaching is often as a failed profession. I point out in the book that it's the only profession that President Obama has year after year singled out in his State of the Union address as needing reform.
Yeah.
And yet, sort of like how people say that they don't like Congress, but they like their individual member of Congress, there's some of that with teaching. You know, we have this national conversation about the failures of teaching, and yet when you ask parents, they'll say, well, I love my child's teacher, or I don't like the teacher this year, but wow, last year we had a great teacher.
Yeah.
So you often hear a lot of enthusiasm among community members for their local teachers and local schools. I ask the question in the book, you know, we have a whole conversation about ineffective educators. Well, how many really are bad?
Yeah.
And I asked a whole bunch of accountability reformers what their answer to the question is, and I got ranges. You know, 1%, 2% of teachers can't improve, maybe 5%, 7%. On the total upward bound, I sometimes heard the number 15%. So if you're looking at a system where maybe 1 to 15% of teachers are these feared, horrible teachers that need to get out of the profession, it means that the vast, vast majority, either they're doing well right now or they can improve to do better.
Yeah. I wanted to get a few things out of the way because you write early on in the book that a few things here. You do not believe schools today are good enough, as I guess as they could be. You also say you don't think poverty and ethnic diversity is preventing the U.S. necessarily from doing better, although it's a function here as well. And one more thing, you say you don't believe teachers and schools alone can solve the crisis. I mean, you're sort of laying out where you start as you dig into the project to sort of give us a sense of where you are, I guess, on all of this.
Yeah, our schools can do better. I mean, we know that our schools are not as academically rigorous in many cases as schools in other parts of the world. And we know that we could do better by our poor children. You know, poor children in other nations, they don't necessarily see as big of an achievement gap with their nation's middle class kids as we have here. So certainly we can be doing a lot better. You know, that said, if you're looking at a place like Japan or Finland, which are countries that we often compare ourselves to educationally, their child poverty rates are a lot lower than ours. So you have to acknowledge that teachers can help close inequality gaps by providing a great education, but they can't do the entire job. Mm. We also have to look at all the other policies that matter, healthcare, housing, you know, all of that other good stuff that helps kids come to school ready to learn.
You say in the book you believe that the education reformers of today should be looking back and learning from the mistakes of history. And I'm wondering, when you first embarked on this project, did you always think this was going to be what it is now in the sense of really digging into the history of all of this?
That's a great question. I actually began, as you know, I am a journalist, so I began in about 2009, 2010, I was going state to state around the country, and I was looking at the politics of public school teaching. And in particular, white teachers felt so embattled and attacked by the political conversation around public education reform. And it was from there that I began to be curious about history, not just because I'm a history buff and I tend to ask historical questions when I'm curious about something, but also I just noticed that we have a huge amount of pressure on education in this country as the path toward meritocracy. It's through our public schools and through excellent teaching that we reassure ourselves that poor children can become middle-class adults. You know, middle-class kids can achieve and be the next Mark Zuckerbergs or Steve Jobses. So I wanted to know, you know, why does it appear, if you look at other Western nations, that Americans put an awful lot of pressure on schools and teachers to do this work?
There is this tension that I wanted to ask you about that I guess it's always been around, and that is between the expectations that we have for teachers and the hope that we have for the system and our inability to invest in it. Have we always had that tension as long as we've been trying to educate people in public systems around the country?
Yeah, certainly. So in the first chapter of the book, I write about Horace Mann, and he is considered the father of our common school system. And in about the 1830s, as a state legislator in Massachusetts, he goes and he asks his colleagues in the legislature to give him $2 million so that he can start compulsory public education in Massachusetts. And what they say is, well, we'll give you $1 million, not $2 million. And so he needs to, you know, establish public education on the cheap for half of what he thought it would cost. And one of the stories I tell in the book is how this really led to teaching becoming a feminized profession over the course of the 19th century. Because, of course, back then you could get away with paying women half as much as men.
Right.
And if we're going to expand education to the masses, we have to be able to have this affordable, even cheap teaching force. So certainly, as long as we've had public education in the United States, we've been arguing over money.
Yeah, I mean, this really influenced the system. And we'll get to this because this is a big part of the story. One of the things that surprised me, I have to say, though, is the impact of religion, particularly this religious revival in the first part of the 19th century that really influenced what I guess was that first education movement.
Yes. At the time, there was increasing Catholic immigration to the United States, and this was something that Protestant reformers were very concerned about, and they linked increased crime rates and public drunkenness to the arrival of especially Irish Catholics in the Northeast. Right. And so one of the reasons they wanted to have public schools was to make sure these kids were getting the proper Protestant moral education. It wasn't a vision of public education that revolved around the intellect or academics. It was really a vision of how do you create a moral adult? How do you take a child and make sure you're developing their character?
That's a question that we and this is another one of those themes that I wanted to ask you about, the question of just really what do people need in the way of education, you know, the question of whether they should get a broad-minded sort of liberal education or whether it should be particular to their vocation. I guess this has been another ongoing question we've asked ourselves as a country.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly at the turn of the 20th century, you see a big push around vocationalism. And this is, again, a time of increased immigration. We also see African-American children coming into the public school system at that time. And you see reformers, especially people coming from the business world, looking at the public schools and saying, well, let's give all of these kids an IQ test, an intelligence test, and then let's track them into the job that it looks likely that they will end up doing. And the unsurprising results of this were that the children of poor laborers ended up being tracked into sort of manual occupations, and the children of college-educated people were the 10% that went on to high school and college. And, you know, I think what we see today is that we're trying and pushing to get away from this idea. We have this ideal today of college for all, but I don't think we often acknowledge how far we've come and what a big shift this is. You know, if we're going to shift into a college for all type of education system, well, our system was not built for that. Our system truly was built, A, with a moral component. Mm-hmm. It was more about teaching children to have good character than teaching them academics. And then after that, we had a vocational component to our schools.
Yeah.
So this idea of college for all is truly a new one.
Let's talk about Catherine Beecher. Catherine Beecher is 22 years old, you point out, when she meets Horace Mann. She's really interesting because she becomes really influential in the education story. And I guess on some level, she's mostly motivated, at least early on, or partially motivated anyway, by this tragedy that comes upon her.
Mm. Yes, her fiancé dies tragically before they get the chance to marry one another. He drowns in a shipwreck off the coast of Ireland. And she needs to figure out what she's going to do with her own personal life now that it looks like she's not going to marry. And what she decides is that school teaching is a wonderful way for a proper young lady like herself to have a sort of public role in the world in a way that's appropriate. And the way she conceives of this is, you know, women are sort of biologically suited to spending their day with children. Just as the mother works with the child in the home, the teacher works with the child in the schoolhouse. And so she goes across the country giving lectures, making this case that as we establish compulsory public education in the mid-19th century in the United States, let's let women teach public school. And although this sounds sort of obvious to us today, because 76% of teachers today are female, in the 19th century, this is a radical argument, because although women worked, you know, as governesses in private homes and they taught girls' schools, it was not really considered appropriate for a middle-class white woman to teach in a co-ed school, boys and girls together. So she's making this case. It befits her own goals to get out of the house and have a life, even though she's not going to get married. But also, she sees this as something that other women would really enjoy doing.
What's the caricature? I mean, the Ichabod Crane character is a caricature, really, of the image of a male teacher of that time, you know, wielding the lash and, you know, beat. How accurate was that as an image? Because they were really seen as quite strict. And as you say, before, you know, Catherine Beecher comes along, they were mostly men in those days.
Yeah, so in 1800, 90% of school teachers were male. And the Ichabod Crane caricature is one I talk about in the book. I mean, there's two things to say about it. First, people like Catherine Beecher and Horace Mann, who wanted women to come into the classroom as teachers, either for idealistic or pragmatic tax cost-based reasons, they kind of played up this idea of the bad male teacher, just like we started our conversation talking about pictures of bad teachers today.
Yeah.
They would say, oh, well, all these men are alcoholics and they love beating children and they're only teachers because they're too stupid to become attorneys or doctors. And, you know, to a certain extent, there may have been an element of truth. I don't think teaching was the most prestigious profession. And for a lot of the 19th century men who were doing it, they were on their way to doing something else. I mean, Herman Melville, the famous writer, is one person I talk about who briefly taught public school, and there was a whole lot of other men like that that were doing it on their way to something better, different. So this picture of the bad male teacher is sort of played up. But secondly, historians have actually looked at historical records from communities around the country in the early 19th century, and they found that most parents were perfectly happy with the male teachers that they had. So there was a sort of gap between rhetoric and reality.
What was education like in those days? Fairly rote as a kind of a system?
Yes, it was quite stultifying. And, you know, most of the schools were one-room schoolhouses, so you might have a child as young as five right nearby a 16-year-old.
Right.
And there would probably be one very young teenage him or herself teacher presiding over all of this. The most common textbook was the Bible, and children would bring their Bibles from home, and the assignments would be from the Bible.
It seems like Beecher, Catherine Beecher, is kind of ambivalent about the feminist part of this story. But it does turn out the experiences for many women, really, it's sort of they got bit by the feminist bug on some levels, you've said.
Yeah, well, Catherine wanted to get out of the house and to teach for her own personal reasons, and she liked the idea of women as moral educators for kids, but she was not a feminist. For example, she did not support suffrage. She didn't believe women should vote. The next generation of female teachers that comes after her is quite different, and Susan B. Anthony is someone that I write about in chapter two of the book. She's a generation younger than Catherine Beecher, and one of her early pushes into feminist activism is through her experience as a teacher, because she sees that she's being paid 50% less than male teachers.
Yeah.
And also, a 19-year-old boy is promoted over her as principal when she's about 30. And the reason why is because it was simply unthinkable that a woman would be a principal. So she really sees inequity, gender-based inequity, through teaching. And for many women, teaching is their first foothold in the public sphere.
Yeah.
And it really triggers their political consciousness.
What's interesting about Susan B. Anthony, as you write, is that she really wants to push back against this convention where a woman got married, and once she did, her pursuit of a career was over. I mean, this was she I think you describe it as sort of a way out of a certain fate for her, that education was didn't have to be connected to a husband, you know.
Yeah, that's a very perceptive point. And again, it's interesting to think about how she's different than Catherine Beecher. I mean, it's one of those intergenerational feminist tensions that we still have today. But Catherine only really thought about making a career of public education after she realized that she was never going to get married.
Right.
And Susan B. Anthony was different. You know, she realized at a very young age that she didn't want to get married. She had a dread of marriage. And she turned down several marriage proposals as a young woman. And she wanted it to be the case that a woman could choose to work no matter what was the state of her personal life.
And teaching as a profession for women becomes a bit of a dispute among the feminists in those early days. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, you write about, she's going around the country giving these speeches where she's telling people to, in fact, not let their daughters go into teaching.
Yeah, so Elizabeth Cady Stanton is a wealthy woman. She's the daughter of a judge and the wife of an attorney, and her seven children are homeschooled privately. And she sees teaching as what she calls a pool of intellectual stagnation. So she's really rebelling against this image of the pure, perfect, underpaid female teacher that the previous generation of reformers had put out there and that, in fact, had become a reality. Over the intervening century, she wants girls to become attorneys and journalists and even to become ministers and run for president. And she's so ambitious for women. And in those ambitions, she actually denigrates public school teaching. Susan B. Anthony, who's been a teacher herself, has a very different approach to speaking about teaching. What's important to her is that teachers be well-educated, that women who are going to become teachers are educated at the best colleges and universities. That's very important to her, and she's prescient on that, I believe. And what's equally important to her is that women teachers be paid fairly. So she sees how women's rights can also sort of elevate the teaching profession.
Mm. One of the questions that comes up in the book is the quality of training, the quality of education for teachers. And you say early on that it is true, the majority of American teachers have academically mediocre backgrounds. But put that in perspective for us, if you would. What have you found about that part? Because you do write about teacher colleges, you talk about training for teachers, those kinds of things.
Well, historically, today's teacher colleges evolved from the early 19th century normal academies. And these normal schools were actually an alternative to high school, not to college. And they accepted girls as young as 6th or 7th grade. They gave them about a year or two of training, sometimes even less than a year. And then they would funnel them right back into the primary school classroom. So you had girls graduating these normal schools like 15 years old and going back to teach. So teacher education has not always been all that rigorous. And there has always been pockets of rigor. So you don't want to paint with too broad of a brush. You know, those normal colleges evolved into state teachers' colleges of today. They do continue to accept most students who apply, and they're in some regions overproducing teachers, especially elementary school teachers and especially English and social studies teachers. One thing I like to point out when I talk about the academic qualifications of teachers are how many teachers there are, because there are 3.4 million American public school teachers. It's the largest civilian occupation in the economy. So anytime you have a group of people that's that large, there's going to be what social scientists call regression toward the mean.
Yeah.
They're going to be somewhat average. And so that's what we see with teachers. We see SAT scores, grades, GPAs, those sorts of measures are about average.
What influence do you think this question of women being involved in the teaching? What was the statistic? 76%, did you say? If teachers
yes,
are still
today,
women?
76%.
Yeah. Is it still thought of? I mean, what are the gender issues still that remain? Are we seeing remnants of that today? Or do you sense that today in the 21st century that women are still being sort of shunted into these kinds of positions for similar kinds of reasons? Maybe we've changed in many ways, but do you see any of those connections still there in any way?
I think a lot has changed since the 1960s. I took a lot of oral histories with older folks who were public school teachers when they were younger for this book. And there's no doubt that, you know, women who entered the profession in the 50s and the early 60s before second wave feminism were often doing so in part because they felt that they couldn't access what they really wanted to do, whether it was law or medicine, journalism, whatever. I think we have to be careful not to romanticize that, though, and assume that feminism has ruined teaching for two reasons. First, Social scientists have looked at teachers' qualifications over time, and they just don't see this drop-off in SAT scores or grades after second-wave feminism. So it's actually hard to see that feminism has led to a drop-off in teacher quality. The second reason why is because when you tell women that teaching is one of only a couple jobs they can do, with maybe nursing or secretarial work being the other options, a lot of women go ahead and become teachers who don't actually want to teach, yeah, don't have a passion for the work, and are not very good at it. So it's easy to romanticize, I think, in our education debate, the time when so many high-achieving women were teachers. But I think you have to also see that women were teaching at the time who didn't actually want to be teaching. You know, today, teaching remains a first step out of the working class for many teachers. They're often the first in their family to go to college. And we see that women continuously are choosing the profession at a greater rate than men. There's a few reasons why. I think we have to look at pay.
Yeah.
The median teacher pay is about $54,000 per year. We know that men are more sensitive to pay when they choose a job than women are. And, you know, secondly, there's still cultural biases around spending your day with children as opposed to adults. And this especially impacts the elementary grades, where we see very, very few men.
Pay equity. Women didn't put up with the pay gap for long anyway. I mean, it's one of those things you write about early on in the system that really motivated the creation of the first teachers' union, which is a really interesting story. Margaret Haley is one of the interesting characters here.
That's right. She's one of the co-founders of the very first teachers-only union in the United States. It's born in 1897. It's the Chicago Teachers Federation. One of the things they're very angry about is that reformers at that time became concerned that it had been a major misstep to attract so many women into the profession. And they were looking around and they were seeing that all these Irish and Italian immigrants were flooding the urban classrooms of New York and Chicago. There were class sizes of 60, 70 children in some cases. And these reformers were saying, you know, maybe women are not tough enough to do this job. And so what they did is they froze female teachers' salaries and sometimes even decreased them in order to try to attract more men and pay men more than women. And Margaret Haley was one of the teachers who just said, no, this is unacceptable. And this is one of the things that motivated the founding of the teachers' union movement.
Dana Goldstein is with us. Her book is called The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. We need to take a quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are asking why it is that public school teachers have become the most controversial profession. Being a teacher has become the most controversial profession in this country. At least that is how journalist Dana Goldstein describes it in her book. Teachers today, she says, are resented, but then they're also idealized. The key to understanding all of this, though, she said, is through history. And she's written a book called The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. So Jeremy on Twitter is asking, he says, a recent Time magazine feature cited teacher tenure as a major fight. Jeremy wants to know, are there so many bad teachers that it's a real issue? This question of teacher tenure you do write about.
Yeah, that's a great question. I trace the history of tenure in the book. I talk about how it started in New Jersey in 1909, and pretty much from the beginning, it's been very controversial to offer teachers the sort of due process on steroids, as it sometimes has been called. But I also conclude in the book that teachers are so subject to political attack that it might make sense for them to have a greater level of job security than you or I. You know, the question of how many bad teachers, I think we addressed it a little bit earlier. Sometimes you hear 1%, sometimes 5%, sometimes 7%, sometimes 15%. But I think when we talk about tenure, about making it easier to fire bad teachers, you have to ask the follow-up question, which is, are we going to replace them with teachers that are better, that are apt to be better at their jobs? And unfortunately, in our high-poverty schools, the ones that are truly the focus of this anti-tenure push among reformers, principals have a very tough time attracting and recruiting teachers to take open jobs, and we see a very high turnover rate. So I'm not convinced that getting rid of tenure is going to be the fix-all for the whole system.
Yeah. Well, plus you point out, and this fairly early in the book, that there's this assumption that teachers enjoy more job security than the private sector, but that's not really true.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the most recent data we have from the federal government seems to suggest that employees of large companies, so companies that have over 1,000 workers, they actually get fired less often than teachers, not more often. So in other words, you know, private sector workers in some cases have more job security than teachers. The fact of the matter is, whether it's a public sector or a private sector employer, in a large bureaucracy, not a lot of firing goes on because it's difficult to do. There's a high standard for documenting why you're doing it, and recruitment is challenging. And so you'd really want to make sure that if you're getting rid of someone, you're not just losing the investment you've made in them. You're giving them the chance to improve.
Let's go to the phones. Fred is with us in Orem, Utah. Fred, welcome.
Oh, hi. I wanted to just say I've been, first of all, almost 25 years of recording all of the debate about school education from the Senate and the Congress. And one time about at the beginning of the President Bush, Secretary of Page, an African-American from Texas who served 4 years, came there at 1 hour speech, and he mentioned that we had a survey of all of the teachers in the nation that 39% of the teachers in math and science, they do not have no minor or major courses in the course that they are teaching. And he pointed out rightfully to that point. Now I want to add, because I have a little bit of time, to say that one of the reasons President Bush, in my opinion, that was elected because concern of the parents about the school system. And when President Bush said that all of the teachers must be tested in the area that they are teaching, teachers union, that is one of, in my opinion, misguided and powerful unions, they all raise the hell. And the Democrats are pretty much supportive of them because they contribute to Democrats. Now,
hold on. Let's. I think you made your point. Let me. Let's get to Dana Goldstein. Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah. I mean, I think we know that internationally, teachers are much more likely to have expertise in math and science than they are here in the United States. And it's a good idea that if a teacher is going to be teaching math or science, they probably ought to have studied it pretty deeply in college. And that would be a reform that I support. The idea that the Democratic Party is totally enthralled to teachers' unions is a bit outdated. I mean, if you go back to 2007 and you see Barack Obama run against Hillary Clinton in the Democratic Party primary for president, you see him booed in front of the National Education Association, the nation's largest teachers' union, for supporting merit pay for teachers tied to students' test scores. So truly, with Barack Obama, folks like Cory Booker, the senator from New Jersey, and many other politicians I could name in the Democratic Party, there's been this shift away from just being lockstep with the unions, and unions have correspondingly had to change their positions.
One of the things you write about in the book, and it's interesting because you come to these, at the end of the book, you offer some of your own kind of ideas for improving education, some of the conclusions that I think you've come to having reported all of this. And one of them, I think, gets a little bit to what Fred was talking about in terms of whether or not teachers are properly educated in the subjects that they're teaching. And this is the difficulty that teaching isn't just one profession. It's several, you point out in the book. So you propose creating what you call these communities of practice, this kind of plural professionalism. Would this be a good time to talk about that?
Yeah, and I thank you for asking me about that, because I think it's probably one of the more complicated ideas in the book. And few people, since it was published September 2nd, have honed in on it. But I do think it's an important idea because we see that, you know, teaching in a suburban school district with very little child poverty, for example, is very different than teaching in an inner city neighborhood. Yeah. You know, some teachers are attracted to wanting to work in a Montessori school. Others like the strict discipline, no excuses world of national charter school chains. And these are just vastly different ways to conceive of what education is for and how we're going to go about delivering education to kids. I think what it's important that we do as a nation is make sure that all of the education our children are receiving is rigorous. And so, you know, you could imagine a world, and some political scientists that I write about in the book have sketched this out, where you could have a teacher's college that was, say, focused on progressive project-based learning that would feed, you know, teachers into a data-driven, research-driven school that uses those practices. And then teachers would be able to student teach while they're in college, and it would all be focused on having the best project-based learning with the best outcomes for kids and just much more dialogue between research and practice than our current system has. You know, we see in the charter school world, the no excuses charter school world, that they are coming closest right now to achieving this, that they have really set out a way of running a school. It's really built around strict discipline, oftentimes a lot of prep for standardized tests, and that they're training teachers that want to work in that environment, and they're having some success. And you know, the point I make in the book is that that model, that sort of coherence, could be brought over to other ways of learning and teaching as well.
One of the things you write about is a teacher observation, teacher evaluation. It's tough because it's subjective, but you write about that that it's important. And you went to this school in the Colorado school system, Fox Meadows Middle School, where they had this pretty intense, it sounds like anyway, superintendent guy by the name of, I'm trying to think of his name now, Mike something.
Mike Miles.
Mike Miles, that's right. And his strategy, I think, is worth talking about. He wanted teachers to keep their doors open at all time during the school day. And he said, look, throughout the year, you're going to expect, you should just expect numerous visits from evaluators. Now, I think a lot of teachers are going to say, that's crazy. That freaks me out when they come in. It puts me off my game. But he thinks it's important. You were skeptical, you say, when you first came to sort of do this part of the story, but you started to see it as pretty effective.
Yeah, I liked the fact that there was a collaborative sense in that school that we're constantly looking at what works best in the classroom, giving teachers hopefully helpful feedback. And if it's not working well, you want to sort of identify that early on. And the more observations you do, the easier it is to do that. You know, one of the things I write about is, as wonderful as it is to give a teacher, you know, 10 or 15 observations in a year, for the typical principal or superintendent, it's just impossible. They don't have the time to do that. And also, when teachers are asked to leave their doors open and have roving teams of administrators and consultants poking their heads in all the time, it can lead to quite, I think, a real sense of anxiety that can pervade a school building and can have some negative ramifications, which is why, in the book, I'm very interested in the idea of peer observation or peer mentorship, where teachers are doing some of that work for one another. And really that there's collaborative communities of practice within school buildings so that this is not just seen as something that's punitive, but something that teachers are doing to help themselves and help one another.
So you want beginning teachers to be exposed to the good ones, the veteran teachers. And you say that that's really going to require some, I guess, some creativity, because you're going to have to restructure a teacher's day to get some of this done. We're going to have to be creative about that.
Yeah. So currently, American teachers spend about 80% of their workday in front of kids. You know, we know in other countries, teachers spend much more time in collaboration with other adults. And this gives novice teachers the chance to work with veterans and learn from veterans. And many of our novice teachers today, you know, their biggest memory of school is from back when they were students themselves. Mm-hmm. They often haven't really had a significant student teaching experience or a significant experience with a mentor professionally. So we do need to restructure the workday for teachers to give them more time to collaborate with one another.
One of the things you write about, too, is just there's a lot to be said about teacher testing and teacher evaluations, and we'll get to some of that. But one thing that I hadn't realized is and this seems important to you, the amount of work that teachers have to really sift through in order to get to these expectations and these evaluations. This woman, I think it's Sabrina Trombetta, another teacher in Colorado Springs, brings that sharply into focus. Would you tell that story?
Yeah, so she is an elementary school art teacher, and what I witnessed was that her kindergarten and first grade art students were actually sitting for a standardized test on paper in elementary school art class, and they were being tested on the standards that were in the Colorado State Standards for Art. Things like what's the difference between a line and a circle, and can you show me orange versus blue? And so she's really sort of having to drill them on those concepts to prepare them, you know, for the test. On the testing day, they're shown a Picasso painting, and they're given an answer sheet, and they have to read the questions and answer questions in full sentences about the Picasso painting. Of course, many of them cannot read yet, so the proctor has to go around and read them the test. And I think this is sort of a moment for me when I saw how all of this push around testing has jumped the shark, because why are these kids being tested? They're being tested so that the teacher can get an evaluation score based on the kid's test score. So in other words, we're not letting the demands of instruction and cognitive science and how children learn drive when we test and how we test. We're testing students in the Obama era primarily to collect the data that we use to create evaluations of their teachers.
Yeah.
This has been the big push of education reform since President Obama came into office and incentivized these types of policies through Race to the Top and his other programs.
So one of your conclusions is return tests to their rightful role.
Yes, and psychometricians or social scientists who study testing have looked at what can a test do and what can't a test do. And tests are really good at telling us what the test taker knows and doesn't know. But they're not so good at, you know, taking that next leap of conclusions about teachers themselves. So we should, when we're giving a child a test, we should make sure that we're focused on the child, that we're seeing what the child doesn't know so that then we can then go back and instruct them more effectively the next time around and fill in those gaps. But to me, that's a much more sort of coherent and scientifically backed use of tests versus using them primarily to judge adults.
Dana Goldstein is with us. Her book is called The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. And we need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Dana Goldstein. We're talking about her book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Another thing that you point out in the book is that the education system needs to find ways to keep teaching interesting. I wanted you to talk about that. How, as you explained, this set of kind of stagnant-seeming responsibilities has left teachers feeling bored and kind of burned out.
Well, when you survey teachers who've left teaching on why, they often say there wasn't a really great opportunity to ascend. Earning more money is part of that, but it also has to do with having a set of responsibilities in year 7 that's different from in year 2, and a set of responsibilities in year 15 and 20 that's different from in year 7. And currently, teaching is an incredibly flat profession. If you stay in the classroom and opt not to take the administrator track, don't become a principal, for example.
Right.
What you do in year 30 and year 2 is going to be quite similar. Of course, you're going to get better. But you're going to be doing, you know, a similar set of responsibilities. So looking at other nations, at places like South Korea and Canada, Singapore, Japan, there's more opportunities for teacher leadership, for teachers to take the next step in their careers by writing curriculum, writing textbooks, by helping other teachers plan their lessons, providing the sort of mentorship that we were talking about in the previous segment. So these are all things that treat teachers like the professionals they are, and as they gain more expertise, allow them to share that with others.
Singapore is interesting. You mentioned they have these, once they're sort of in the system, I think like 3 years, then they have these options of taking these, what you call these leadership paths. What's that about?
Right. So once you're in the job for a few years, if you're doing well, you get to choose to specialize either in instructional mentorship, so helping novice teachers learn to plan lessons and deliver them, in curriculum, or in policy. So really, it's showing teachers that, you know, you can take the next step and become an educational leader. And I think it's a wonderful model.
This may be perceived as controversial, and I know anytime you talk about teachers' unions, it is. But you do point out in the book that it's time to end some of the protections in teachers' unions that are outdated. Explain what you mean. What are some of those protections that you see of sort of are obsolete at this point?
Well, since the recession hit, unfortunately, school districts across the country did sometimes have to lay teachers off because of budget cuts. And in many cases, a policy called Last In, First Out, or LIFO, protected senior teachers, teachers with more years of experience, regardless of whether or not they were as effective as younger or less experienced teachers. And what I write in the book is that this doesn't really make a lot of sense now that we have much more research about what effective classroom instruction looks like. Really interesting research coming from cognitive scientists, from education researchers, from economists. We're starting to build a sort of body of accepted best practices in teaching. So I reject the idea that you can't tell the difference between a good and a bad teacher. And as long as we accept that basic fact that there is a difference and we can tell the difference and experts can tell the difference, I think it follows from that that seniority should be a tiebreaker in these types of situations. It shouldn't be the only factor.
Teachers' pay matters, you say. That's an important one. You also talk about a big problem is the way teacher pay is structured. Give us a sense first. Where do American teachers sit compared to other countries, for example, in terms of pay?
That's a great question because American teachers don't actually make a lot less than teachers in other nations in terms of raw salary. However, our economy is structured differently. So if you look at Finland, there's not as big of a gap between a teacher's salary and an attorney's salary, for example, as we have here. If you look at South Korea, a teacher makes almost as much as an engineer. Here, a teacher makes about half or 60% as much of an engineer, depending on where in the country you are. So we have a lot of inequality in our labor market, and this makes teaching less attractive on the American scene than it is in some other nations. One thing I look at in the book in terms of resolving that is the way teacher pay is structured. So we know that the average entry-level salary hovers around $30,000, that the median pay is $54,000. In some big urban districts like New York City, where I'm speaking to you from today, teachers can, at the top of their careers after, say, 25 or 30 years, earn a nice six-figure salary. But it takes so long to get there. And what we know is that it's really in, you know, a teacher's mid to late 20s that they're making the decision about whether or not to stay. So it's important to bring some of those raises into those first 10 or 15 years when teachers are, you know, thinking about starting a family, buying a home, all those things that young adults do, and they start to look at their college-educated peers, and they're thinking to themselves, why is it that I am so broke?
Yeah. How important is the principal in a school in the scheme of things?
Yeah, crucially important, because in surveys of top third teachers, so our best teachers, if you ask them the number one thing that would inspire them to take a job, they say it's a great principal. So there's really no way to get these excellent teachers to our neediest kids, especially our high-poverty kids, if we don't emphasize putting great principals in those schools.
One of your recommendations is, as you put it, to be real about the limitations. You say there are times when we engage in this kind of magical thinking about the system. What's the magical thinking we engage in sometimes about education?
There's two things I'll say. I both begin and end the book by making the point that the U.S. Constitution does not mention education as a right.
Yeah.
So our Constitution leaves education as a responsibility of state and local governments. So this means that as much as Bill Gates or President Obama would love to reform the system from the top down, we actually don't have a political structure in place that makes that very easy. And the reason why is only, you know, 12% of the funding for the local schools comes from the federal government. So the federal government can't actually control all that much what local schools do. You know, they set certain standards and they can tie that 12% to school districts doing certain things. And oftentimes that 12% is so important in a situation of scarcity for districts that they do change the way they evaluate teachers, let's say. Mm. But then at the level of implementation of these policies, they get no help, which is why I see, you know, kindergartners taking a very poorly conceived test in art class in Colorado because nobody is coming in and helping that district create a better test. And so it's hard when we don't have a lot of quality control in our system to believe that these big national reform ideas are going to just overhaul everything and make everything better. So that's why I argue in the book that we need to look more at what works locally.
Mm-hmm.
We need to look at what teachers are doing right in their classrooms and make sure they have the time in their days to share those best practices with other educators, because ultimately the most sustainable reforms are not built from the top down but from the bottom up.
There's this race going on, this congressional race, where one of the candidates is being accused of not supporting the federal Department of Education, and it's becoming kind of an issue in that race. And it made me wonder, do you think we should have a federal Department of Education?
Oh, yes, I absolutely think we should. And this is not new, by the way. I write in Chapter 8 of the book how President Ronald Reagan ran for office in 1979 and 1980, swearing to shut it down. Of course, we've only had the Federal Department of Education since Jimmy Carter's presidency. But what the Federal Department of Education primarily does is disperse this grant program called Title I. Mm. And it's really important. This is billions of dollars specifically for the education of poor children and disabled children and other children with various special needs. So when you hear someone say that they don't support the Department of Education, it should raise the question, well, what do you think about those programs that pay for things like, you know, special tutoring for kids that are falling behind in high poverty neighborhoods? This is very important stuff.
You worry that, I guess you must worry about the political landscape, the current political landscape, and how that's going to make teachers feel, in some cases, probably even more embattled. But you also think there is some reason for hope. Are we coming back to that first question where you said you thought we were headed out of this idea of this moral panic? I mean, you seem optimistic, I guess, these days.
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing about education and what has engaged me on it as a journalist for nearly a decade now is it's not a simple left-right issue. You see, there's been a bipartisan consensus around pushing on standardized testing as sort of the single most effective tool for fixing education. And on both the right and the left, you've seen critiques of that. And I think what we're seeing now is that the center has become more sensitive to those critiques. And you actually had Arne Duncan, of course, the Secretary of Education, saying about a month ago that we may need to take a bit of a timeout on all of this standardized testing, and we need to make sure we're not pushing too hard on it, that we're not creating too many incentives for adults that are tied to these unstable test scores. And sometimes the tests themselves are very low quality, unfortunately. So this kind of consensus that's building to look critically at the policies of the past 15 years since No Child Left Behind, wonder what's next, pay more attention to teachers' voices. I see more and more people in the debate saying we have to make sure teachers are part of the conversation. All of this makes me hopeful.
Dina Goldstein, her book is The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. She joined us from NPR in New York. Dina Goldstein, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you for giving the book such a close read.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Michael Shea, technical direction from Mike Anderson, the show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.